One day, Lyman Pang and his daughter Ling Zhao were out selling bamboo baskets. Coming down off a bridge, Lyman Pang stumbled and fell. When Ling Zhao saw this, she ran to her father's side and threw herself to the ground. "What are you doing?" cried Pang. "I saw you fall, so I'm helping," replied Ling Zhao. "Luckily, no one was looking," remarked Lyman Pang. "So I saw you fall, so I'm helping. It's funny, right? But there's also great wisdom in it. I think that if you're passionate about justice and you want to do something to help, this is a great koan. I saw you fall, so I'm helping has a lot of insight about this. I'm a computer programmer, and I work in an industry that's infamous for young, white, male privilege. But the software industry, it hasn't always been this way. It was invented by women. The first computer programmer was Ada Lovelace. She was an aristocratic English woman, and she was recognized as a math talent in her teen years. She was assisting an English inventor named Charles Babbage. And Babbage was working on a design for something that he called an analytical engine. Babbage's analytical engine would have been a gigantic computer made out of steel and bronze gears and other mechanical parts. It would have weighed many tons. It would have been the size of a truck. And it would have been a real computer with the ability not just to do calculations on numbers, but also to do things like if-then statements and to do iteration. It could have looped until a condition was true. The authoritative description of Babbage's design for the analytical engine was written by Ada Lovelace in 1842. And her description contains a program that she wrote, the first computer program in history. Her program calculates a series of numbers called the Bernoulli sequence, and you can see it to this day. She wrote it out with quill, and it looks shockingly modern. She uses terms like data and intermediate variables and result variables and operations. It's incredible. It's in 1842 that she's designing this modern-looking computer program. And she also had the insight that computers could do more than just math. They might compose music, for example. Lovelace wrote that the analytical engine might act upon other things besides numbers, supposing, for instance, that the fundamental relations of pitched sounds in the science of harmony and of musical composition were susceptible of such expression. The engine might compose elaborate and scientific pieces of music of any degree of complexity or extent. So Ada Lovelace was the first computer programmer 100 years before it was possible to actually run a program. The kind of programming she pioneered, it was called, we would call it today, machine language programming. She was programming directly in the language that the computer could execute. But this isn't the kind of programming that I or almost anybody does today. We now use programming languages that are designed for humans to rigorously express algorithms, and then a computer programmer called a compiler translates our computer programs from programming language into machine language so that it can be executed. And this idea of using a computer program to translate a programming language into machine language, this too was invented by a woman. Her name was Grace Hopper. She was a woman working for the U.S. Navy. She is among the longest-serving people in U.S. military history and one of the highest-ranking women. She came up with her idea for a compiler in the 1950s, and unlike Ada Lovelace, Grace Hopper actually had hardware that she could demonstrate her ideas on. She could execute programs. She got her first compiler working in 1952. And she said nobody believed that. I had a running compiler and nobody would touch it. They told me computers could only do arithmetic. But of course they were wrong, and Grace Hopper's invention of a compiler is the foundation of the modern software industry. Everything we do today goes back to that. So computer programming was invented by women, and as it expanded into a mainstream industry, women were reasonably well represented at first. So in 1984 in the US, 37% of bachelor's degrees in computer science went to women. It's not equal. Barely a third of these degrees were going to women. But it was at least similar to other science and technology fields, and in retrospect, the 1980s appear like a golden age for women in computing, because after that, something bad happened. Women's portion of bachelor's degrees in computer science dropped from 37% in the 1980s to only 12% in this decade. Women's share of undergraduate degrees is now lower in computer science than in any other science and technology field. So why is that? What happened? One thing is that as computers became household items, marketed to the masses, they were marketed to boys in magazines that boys read with photographs of boys using the computers. Additionally, the computer programmer went from being an unknown specialty to being a household recognized kind of person, and the stereotype of the computer programmer is the nerdy white male, which discouraged anybody who's not a white male from wanting to join that culture. Additionally, I think towards the late 1980s, people like Bill Gates demonstrated that knowing how to program a computer was an avenue to wealth and power. And so white men did what we do when we have access to wealth and power, which is that we ensure that other kinds of people won't compete with us for that privilege. We excluded women and people of color and anybody who wasn't like us from competing with us for that money, power, and prestige. And then, in the early aughts, the Silicon Valley startup culture became the dominant culture within the larger software industry. And that meant that not only were computer programmers overwhelmingly white men, but they were also overwhelmingly young. And that culture of young white men created this sort of fraternity-like, immature atmosphere that gave license to the worst sexist and biased behaviors. The result of this is that women dropped to as little as 10 or 15% of leading companies' technical staff, and additionally, that senior computer programmers were even more overwhelmingly male than computer programmers on the whole. The National Center for Women in Tech says that 56% of women leave the computer programming industry mid-career, which is double the exit rate of men. So at the most senior and powerful and prestigious levels, women are even rarer than in the industry as a whole. So growing up and becoming a computer programmer myself, I knew that most computer programmers were men, but it didn't really occur to me that there was a cause for that, or that there was anything I could do about it. I started my CS degree in 1997, and I noticed that there were very few women, but I figured that since I was a lifelong feminist and I was not myself a bigot or a sexist, that was good enough, and that there wasn't anything that I can or should do to fix the problem of diversity in the software industry. And I think a lot of us felt that way too. Liberal white men kind of felt that we'd done our job by being liberals, and there wasn't really anything we could do. And that was okay because we'd already done enough by not being biased ourselves. And we weren't particularly aware even of the activists who were trying to raise awareness about the causes of the imbalance and the injustices, much less their efforts to fix it. The history of why that changed hasn't yet been written. We're right in the middle of it, and it's a very exciting time. It feels like overnight the software industry has awakened, and everybody is talking about feminist issues, and everybody is talking about racism and other axes of oppression, when just a few years ago we weren't. And I've been trying to figure out why that is. It seems like maybe there was a watershed year in late 2008 and 2009 when all of a sudden everybody realized that we had problems with diversity and with inclusion. So in late 2008, a Silicon Valley newspaper, the San Jose Mercury News, along with CNN, sued the largest Silicon Valley firms and sued them to release their diversity statistics. What proportion of their computer programmers and their staff in general were women or minorities? And most of the companies fought these requests, and most of them won. But the stats that we did find were pretty horrifying. 10 to 15% of programmers at these companies were women. And the numbers for minorities were even worse. 3% were Hispanic and 1% were black. So we knew we had a problem with diversity. And the next year, there were a whole series of sexist incidents at conferences back to back that showed that not only were we homogenous, but we were also exclusive. We'd created a hostile and biased culture. So, for example, at a San Francisco conference, a programmer gave a talk called Perform Like a Porn Star, where he said that his database would make your application perform quickly, perform well, perform like a porn star. And his opening slide was a photo of a woman's ass. And if you go to the Geek Feminism Wiki, you can read a whole list of these sexist incidents at conferences. I won't disgust you with any more of them. The point is that having them close together, well-publicized, and completely disgusting woke us up to the fact that there was something that we needed to transform about our culture if we were going to welcome women and minorities, and treat them fairly. So we recognized that Layman Pang had fallen down, right? Ling Zhao's first step is to see that he's fallen down and to run over and want to help. So, what can we do? What works? Well, there's a new book that I'm reading. It's called What Works by Iris Bonnet, and the subtitle is Gender Equality by Design, and it was published just this March. And she examines a lot of studies and tries to figure out what works to improve gender equality specifically, but diversity in general. So, first of all, she examines whether diversity trainings work. And there's bad news here. She finds that, at least in the studies she reviews, diversity trainings might actually be counterproductive. One study shows that managers who've just taken a gender bias workshop are actually more likely to discriminate against women candidates that they interview right after they've taken this gender bias workshop. And a couple of the theories for why this happens is, one, that taking that workshop feels like eating your vegetables, and once you've been a good boy and you've taken that workshop, then you have free rein to indulge in your biases, the same as after you've worked out, you're allowed to have a piece of chocolate. Another theory for why this fails is that a superficial workshop merely draws one's attention to gender differences without uprooting the biased attitudes about gender, and that contributes to discrimination. Now, you have to take studies, I think, with a grain of salt. Every workshop is different. All participants are different. I'm actually convinced that diversity workshops like the ones we've had at the Village Zendo from Tiffany Taylor Smith are useful. I think it really depends on who takes them and how they're presented. But so far, it looks like a lot of them are a failure. Another big failure was just this year. IBM wanted to attract girls to get into the technology industry, and so they released a video ad called Hack a Hairdryer. And Hack a Hairdryer showed girls using pink or violet-colored hair dryers in novel ways. So a girl invents a ping pong cannon that's powered by a hairdryer, or invents a musical instrument like a pipe organ that's powered by a hairdryer. And this is supposed to show that invention can be girly too. Now, when a bunch of people criticized IBM and pointed out how condescending and patronizing this thing was, to IBM's credit, they almost immediately deleted the video and apologized. And it's atypical for IBM, which has actually been one of the best at recruiting and promoting women. But sometimes, if you're not really intimate with the people you're trying to communicate with or the problem you're trying to address, you can really make serious missteps. And I think what both of these examples, both the diversity workshop and the Hack a Hairdryer video, are examples of is a lack of intimacy. It's as if Ling Zhao had walked over to Layman Pang and just stood over him with her hand out and said, "Come on, get up, what's your problem?" But that's not what Ling Zhao did. She threw herself to the ground next to him in order to help him. She got dirty. She devoted her whole body to being down there with him in order to help. And that's an example of what we call in Buddhism upaya, or skillful means, which is speaking in the proper context, taking into account who is speaking, who is listening, the time and the place, in order to make a message that's truly effective, that really acknowledges the full situation. So, what does work? In the last few years, we've seen a lot of new activism and techniques applied that really do make a difference in gender equality and in diversity in general. One thing that works is codes of conduct for conferences, which say out loud what is unacceptable behavior, so that the next time somebody shows a slide that says perform like a porn star, Everybody knows that that's unacceptable and will get you banned from the conference. A really incredibly effective and hardworking feminist activist named Valerie Aurora, who has been active in the open source community for years, wrote the original code of conduct that most software conferences now use if they have a code of conduct. And right-thinking programmers won't speak at a conference or sponsor a conference that doesn't have a code of conduct in place. Another thing that really works is outreach. In the last years, there have been dozens of new outreach programs for women and girls with names like Women Who Code, Pi Ladies, Black Girls Code, Geek Girls, Girls Who Code. Many others all have been founded by women within the last few years, and they are extremely effective. Outreach to women to speak at conferences has also been extremely effective. So, the main conference in my specialty is called PyCon. It's the main annual conference for people who use the Python programming language, which is my specialty. Speaking at PyCon is a highlight of one's career. There are thousands of people at that conference, and thousands of people watch the videos afterward. But as late as 2011, only 1% of PyCon speakers were women. So by 2012, they decided that they needed to do something about this. Another very effective activist named Jessica McKellar was PyCon's diversity outreach chair, and in 2012, she simply reached out and asked women who had proven themselves as speakers at other conferences to apply to speak at PyCon. So this isn't affirmative action. It doesn't change the selection process. It's merely telling women who might not have thought of it that they deserve to be heard at PyCon and they should submit a talk. As a result, in 2012, the number of women speakers went from 1% to 7%, the next year 15%, and the next year 33%. So that kind of outreach really works. Mentorship and sponsorship also work. In Iris Bonnet's book, I read that women have a hard time finding mentors. And this is especially true in the software industry, since the sort of senior people who can mentor women are mainly men, since that's who is in these senior positions. And men are less willing and less able to mentor women effectively. Additionally, one study suggests that when women do have mentors, these mentors tend to act more as friends rather than as guides and as sponsors. That is, they don't act as effectively to promote the careers of the women whom they are mentoring and to advocate for them getting raises and promotions and other contributions that would advance their careers. So, in my mind, filling this gap is one of the most effective things that men in privileged positions can do to help close the gender gap as well as other diversity gaps. So, that's been something that I've been making my priority. At my company, there have been three young women who were starting out as professional programmers whom I've made an investment in mentoring. And one of the main things I do is to encourage them to submit talks to conferences and help them through that whole process of writing a good proposal and then constructing an effective talk. One young woman whom I mentored, named Samantha, got a talk into a Portland conference last year. It was the first big open source conference that she'd spoken at. And this year, she has mentored another young woman at my company to also propose a talk and to give it at the same conference. So that investment that I made is rippling out and compounding over time. Another young woman I mentored, Anna, I've been advocating for her for many years, and I pushed her to speak at a New York City regional Python conference. And based on the strength of that talk, she's given talks at two or three other open source conferences over the last years. And sure enough, this year she got the email from Jessica McKellar suggesting that she should propose a talk to PyCon. And she got in, and that means that next week she's going to give a talk at the most prestigious conference in our specialty, which is an incredible accomplishment for a young programmer. And it means that she'll get the recognition that her talent deserves. Whereas if I hadn't been sponsoring her for these years, she might have remained overlooked. So that kind of mentorship and sponsorship really works. And the final thing I'll point out is that ally skills work. One thing that I and privileged liberal people like me have been awakened to in these last few years is that it's not enough for we ourselves simply to be unbiased. I mean, first of all, of course, we've discovered that we are not unbiased. We've uncovered our unconscious biases to some extent. But that's not even what I'm talking about. What we've really had to learn is that you can't be neutral. You can't just say, I'm not a sexist, and have that be enough. You actually have to be an effective ally. And in order to be an effective ally, you have to learn ally skills. And this is the same kind of insight that, as Buddhists, we apply to all other kinds of ethical behavior. Like, we know that even if wisdom and compassion are innate, we aren't innately skilled at expressing our wisdom and compassion effectively and at transforming our society. So we have to learn skills and practice them in order to be effective. And it's the same with being an effective ally to women and minorities. So luckily, there's a workshop. Valerie Aurora, the activist whom I mentioned, besides writing code of conduct for conferences, she has also created this ally skills workshop. And I took this workshop a few months ago, along with Kayshen, she was there too. And what Valerie does is she leads the group through a series of scenarios where we witness a microaggression and we learn to recognize them and also quick and extremely effective ways to intervene as an ally. One example is, let's say you're in a meeting and a woman with a disability suggests an idea, and everybody ignores her. And then a minute later, a person in a position of privilege, let's say a white man, proposes the same idea, and everybody listens and claps and applauds this man's great idea. What do you do? So in the workshop, we would split up into little groups and kind of brainstorm about what an effective response might be for somebody like me in the room, also in a position of privilege. And what we came up with is to say something like, oh, I heard Sarah a minute ago propose that idea. Hey, Sarah, did you have anything else that you wanted to say about your idea? So what this does is it draws fire to me. I'm the person being rude. I'm the person pointing out that this was originally Sarah's idea. And I should be the one to be rude and draw fire to myself because my privilege protects me. Once I've done that, I should then recenter the conversation around the person who is being overlooked. I should turn the stage back over to her and allow her to take the attention and the credit for her original idea. So this is a general principle that can be applied to a lot of interventions as an ally, but it doesn't come naturally. In order to be quick enough and precise enough to do it well, you need to practice. And that's what the Ally Skills Workshop is about practicing to be an effective ally so that what you do will work. And talking about being an ally, it brings us to other axes of diversity besides gender. So, as far as I can see, in this sudden awakening in the software industry, we are having productive conversations about gay people in the industry. We are also beginning to talk about discrimination against minorities, against people with mental illness, against transgender people and people with disabilities. At any given progressive conference or company, you'll see discussions of these axes of oppression and maybe even specific accommodations to ensure that members of these underrepresented groups are treated fairly. Much less so, I think, are we seeing a awakening about ageism. I think that older programmers have been so effectively excluded from the industry and from the conversation that we aren't even aware of their absence most of the time, and we're not yet beginning to discuss the causes of that exclusion or how to fix it. And neither are we talking about class issues, about people who grew up working class without access to the fancy educational privileges that most people who become computer programmers have access to, and we're not talking about immigrants very much. In particular, the thing that we're overlooking is the fact that Asian Americans, whether immigrants themselves or children of immigrants, although they make up something like 30% of the computer industry workforce, their percentage in the industry leadership is far, far lower. There's a glass ceiling in effect. It seems like we're happy to take advantage of their labor, but much less interested in their leadership. And that is so uncomfortable for us to acknowledge that it's extremely rarely discussed. But nevertheless, there is very rapid and very promising beginnings to a general awakening about social justice and diversity. Compared to all of the companies that refused to release their diversity stats in 2008, now most of the top companies, including mainly Google, led the charge, and now Twitter and Facebook and Amazon and most of the household names companies have released their statistics about the proportion of their workforce who are women or who are racial minorities. And in my own company, we're suddenly waking up. We're going from being a group of people who are liberal and welcoming and bemoan our lack of diversity to a group of people who is actually talking about the causes of that exclusion and making a real commitment to figuring out what to do about it. And that's just, it's such a privilege for me to be in the industry at this moment of a general enlightenment beginning, and of everybody going from bemoaning the injustice to making a commitment to fixing it. So, If this reminds you at all of your culture, of your sangha, of your company, what I want to tell you is don't despair. I really mean it. Don't despair. If you're watching national politics on the news, there's a lot of bad shit, and it's all much too big for you or me to have any effect on, and it's easy to become super discouraged. But don't despair, because if you concentrate on what's right in front of you, who is right in front of you, who has fallen down, you just have to commit your whole body to throwing yourself down into the dirt and helping.